Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, 50 years have passed since the infamous speaker ban law was passed by the legislature, by the North Carolina legislature, as UNC student body, as then UNC student body president Bob Spearman knows, or he was the student body president when he was helped leading a fight against this of the law. He experienced it. And he's now lecturing about it at the Wilson Library is a big deal. And what I wanted to do is to get Bob to come in and talk to us a little bit about that lecture and about the facts of the speaker ban law, not to give the lecture to us, but to talk about it. And first of all, welcome, Bob Spearman.
Thank you very much, D.G. I appreciate it.
You've got a lot of friends in Chapel Hill because you grew up here, and your dad is a legendary, you know, member of the faculty of the journalism school, much loved even and remembered even after many years. But then you went to Raleigh to practice law, but you've seen the light. You've moved back to Chapel Hill.
I've moved back to Chapel Hill. That's right. My wife and I are now living over in Environ Way, and we moved back to Chapel Hill a couple of years ago.
How do you begin to tell the story of the speaker ban law? It sucked us up by the head by surprise. I mean, it just came out of the blue, it seemed.
Well, it did certainly come out of the blue back when it happened. I don't think, in fact, it was pretty clear that Bill Friday and Bill Aycock had only heard about the law after it had already passed the House of Representatives. So that gives you some kind of idea of what it was like. And another thing is that actually the first two folks from the university who got over there, I mean, who were employed by the university, who got over there to try to check on what in the world was going on, were in fact Bill Friday and Fred Weaver, who was then the university vice president. And by the time they got over there, not only had it passed the House, which it passed, I must say, in about 4 minutes, it had also passed by that point the state Senate as well. And it took 20 minutes in the U.S.
This is incredible.
In the state Senate for it to pass.
Because, I mean, we have this notion that the legislature might make a lot of mistakes, but it is a deliberative body which doesn't ordinarily just take up legislation and pass it. It sends it to committees that have a chance to take a good hard look at a proposed legislation. It's imperfect, but it does give people a chance to be very careful about what kind of laws they pass. And this, why did that not happen with the speaker ban law?
Well, that's a big question, D.G. I think the simplest answer is that one thing that was in the background the whole time that the speaker ban, the short time, I should say, that the speaker ban was being considered, was a series of demonstrations about race. And in fact, if you go back and sort of look at the history and the political history of the whole matter, in February, I believe it was, of 1960, was the beginning of the sit-in demonstrations at Woolworths in Greensboro, where some students from A&T went in and said they wanted to be served at Woolworths and asked to be served at Woolworths and were turned away. And thereafter, there were an increasing number of demonstrations. But one thing that happened, which is very interesting and sort of unusual, is that initially most of the demonstrations were in larger cities. They were in towns like Greensboro and cities like Charlotte. But they were not, by and large, in eastern North Carolina. And what got it all going in eastern North Carolina was in the spring of 1963, which was the year the speaker ban was adopted, a lady whose name was Angie Brooks, who had formerly been the librarian ambassador to the United Nations, but who was a Raleigh native, had come back to attend some events in Raleigh. And she went downtown with a couple of students from Shaw and a couple of students from North Carolina State, and with one state faculty member who was someone who many of us knew, who was Al Lowenstein. And that little group went downtown and they went by the Sir Walter coffee shop. And she led them in there and they asked to be served at the coffee shop. And not only were they not served at the coffee shop, but the fellow who was running the coffee shop said, "No, Miss Brooks, but maybe you would like to have a job working here." Mm. Well, that was the beginning of the demonstrations in Raleigh. That was the beginning of the demonstrations. And another characteristic of them really is the fact that many of the legislators, be they in the House or be they in the Senate, had really not seen much by way of race demonstrations or racial demonstrations before. Because as I said a few minutes ago, most of them had been in Charlotte and most of them had been in Raleigh. But beginning with this episode involving Miss Brooks, there were a number of them which were in Raleigh. And that began to build up a lot of tension. And it built up a tension in the sense that many of the legislators, particularly those from Eastern North Carolina, were just especially offended by the whole idea that some black people and a few white people with them would be walking around and demonstrating.
But racial demonstrations had nothing to do with communism, and the speaker ban law tried to address the as I remember it. It just said if you're a communist or affiliated with a communist or have maybe taking the Fifth Amendment, you're not allowed to speak on university property.
Well, that's right.
And didn't say anything about race, did it?
It did not say anything about race. But it's pretty clear if you look at it in retrospect, or even if you were looking at it really back at the time, that the racial component and the communist component were really very, very much intertwined. And I know I wrote a paper about the topic when I was at Chapel Hill. And I know that one of the people whom I interviewed was our then Secretary of State, Thad Ewer. And Thad Ewer said, and I'm more or less quoting him, "You've got to remember that it was the racial demonstrations that cast the spark that set off the law that became the speaker ban law."
Wow.
So he certainly said that. And another man who was a very great proponent of the speaker ban law was a gentleman who was then the president of the Senate named Clarence Stone.
Cac Stone. Yeah, is that right? Now, tell us about it. Yeah, tell us about how they got this thing on the table.
The way they got it on the table is the background involved the racial demonstrations, for one thing, and that was very, very important. Another thing that was at issue in the whole background was the fact of there were other controversial issues. One of them was the controversial issue about what would the name change be, if any name change there would be, about North Carolina State, and would it be renamed the University of North Carolina at Raleigh? That became a big issue. And many of the people who were proponents of the speaker ban law were people who were very much opposed to changing the name of North Carolina State to the University of North Carolina at Raleigh. And in fact, one of those folks even was bitterly, bitterly complaining that the Governor's Commission on Higher Education had gone out to California and they had found a university system that had a whole lot of people in it who were foreign-born. And with all those foreign-born people, they brought that whole concept back to North Carolina and tried to implement it, and were trying to implement it in North Carolina. So that was another thing that was at issue.
There was skepticism about the university then that went beyond speakers or race or anything, just this university.
Well, there's always been skepticism about the university in a sense that, if you go back to the so-called monkey laws in the 1920s, there was a major proposal to try to prevent the teaching of evolution in North Carolina schools. But that one, unlike the speaker ban, that law and many other attempts to sort of silence things or silence people at the university, unlike a lot of them, those were all aired out and talked about and discussed, and in most cases, they just didn't pass. Whereas the speaker ban, whatever one thinks about it and whatever position one had about it, it really was kind of slipped in there at the last minute, and they got it through very quickly.
We're visiting with Bob Spearman. We're talking about the speaker ban law in North Carolina, which was passed about 50 years ago. Bob Spearman was the president of the student body at Carolina. He's telling us, and he's given a lecture on this topic, and he's given us a little inside information about it. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about the speaker ban law. Golly, 50 years ago, it seems like yesterday. It is if you don't know about it, it's a very big part of the history of the University of North Carolina, and there's a monument right there on Franklin Street to remind us of how important. Bob Spearman, who grew up in Chapel Hill, now has practiced law in Raleigh, has come back to Chapel Hill to live, has been studying this for a lecture at the Wilson Library. And Bob, you're sharing with us some of the inside story. We're talking about how it got passed.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to do that, DG. I guess just before the short break we took, that you were asking about what else was happening in the legislature. And another thing that was happening in the legislature, which is rather interesting, is at this same point in time, that is the very end of May and the early parts of June, there was a proposal to set up something which most everybody has now forgotten about, but it was called the Supreme Court of the Union. And the Supreme Court of the Union was a proposed federal constitutional amendment. And by that federal constitutional amendment, if it had ever passed, which it didn't, but if it had ever passed, it would have set up a court, a new court, comprised of the 50 chief justices of all 50 states. And the power of the Supreme Court would have been essentially ceded to this Court of the Union proposal, or under this Court of Union proposal. Now, one thing that I've always found very amusing about that is it turned out that was one of the many issues upon which Governor Sanford, who had been elected by defeating Beverly Lake back in 1960, in the 1960 Democratic primary, he was very much opposed to this whole idea about any federal court of the union, and he was taking it upon himself to do a good bit of lobbying, just personal lobbying, to try to persuade senators and representatives to vote against it. And one time he decided he was going to go talk to somebody who actually was a senator from the Piedmont. But in any event, at this point, Sanford decided he would have a heart-to-heart with this gentleman. And he said to him, "Now, I just don't know how you feel about this Court of the Union law or Court of the Union proposal." And to which the senator said to him, "Well, Terry, I just need to know one thing, and I just need to know whether it's really a good old conservative American proposal or whether it's a John Birch proposal." And Sanford, in his inimitable fashion, said, "Oh, there's just no question about it. It's a John Birch proposal." To which the senator said, "Well, that's what I thought, Terry. And so that means I'm against it, because I'm for anything that's American and conservative, but I'm against anything that's a Birchite proposal." So that was another thing that was just thrown into the mix there. And I guess your other question to me was just how did it get through so fast? And it got through so fast simply because it's rather interesting that somebody who often through his entire lifetime was very critical of the university, Jesse Helms, was really lobbying or was certainly talking about a proposal that was then pending in the Ohio legislature. And that the Ohio bill was very much like the bill that ultimately became the law in North Carolina for several years. But Jesse Helms had a program, I believe it was on Thursday or Friday night before the speaker ban law was adopted about 5 days later. And in that program that that Jesse Helms was talking about. He said that he just thought that the Ohio legislature ought to be commended because it was not pussyfooting about these issues. Well, Ned Delamar, who was a representative from Pamlico County in eastern North Carolina, Ned Delamar heard that, and he went in and talked to Thad Ure. I guess it was maybe the next day. And he asked Thad Ure to see if Thad Ure could get him a copy of this fine bill, which they had just was under consideration still in Ohio. And Delamar got a copy of that bill, and as Ure got it for him. And Ure then went over to the Attorney General's office and talked to the North Carolina then Attorney General, Wade Bruton, and his assistant, Harry McGalliard, and they sort of fine-tuned the bill just a very little bit and then gave it to Delamar, and Delamar was off and running with it, and I think it was on a Tuesday, June 25, that Delamar went by to see a good friend of his whose name was Godwin, and the two of and asked Godwin if he would agree to sponsor it with Delamar. And, of course, Godwin thought this was just a very fine bill, too, and they agreed to do it. And then that morning, they collected a few more signatures. I had 5, 6, 7, 8 people sponsoring it by the time that it was introduced in the House. And when it was introduced in the House, the Speaker, who was then Cliff Blue, had already agreed that he knew it was going to be taken up. And Godwin moved to suspend the rules and just consider it there on the spot. And he said, it's not a very controversial bill, he says, because, you know, we just want to keep these communists from plying their trade on our state university campuses. And so they got it through.
Well, Bob, you and I have both done a little lobbying, and the legislature today customarily has a deadline for filing bills. Yeah, and for new yeah. legislation, but legislators find ways to get around that limit. By amending existing bills and so forth, but did they have that kind of limit back then?
In both the House and the Senate, DG, the rules were just completely suspended in order to suspended all rules and considered it there on the spot.
We forget that the legislature has. I mean, we're learning again. In contemporary times, that the legislature is almost fully empowered to do whatever they want to do.
Well, that's right.
Unless there's a governor to veto what they do. So, yes.
And, of course, back in those days, another thing worth bearing in mind is that the governor, the North Carolina governor, did not have a veto. Mm-hmm. So Governor Sanford, who was then the governor of North Carolina, did not have a veto. And, in fact, Sanford several times remarked to people thereafter that he only thought he needed a veto one time when he was governor, and that was when the legislature passed the speaker ban.
Well, what happened? It got passed. You mentioned that President Friday hurried over there to try to stop it. Is this something, you know, we think of President Friday as being sort of the guy who could get anything done, but there were times when he was not all-powerful. And so I wonder, could he have stopped it?
There were times when he was not all-powerful, and obviously the speaker ban in various ways was one of them. But he got over there after the Senate and the House had both adjourned for the day, and they went down to, he and Fred Weaver went down to the Sir Walter Hotel, where the two things are important about that. One is that that's where lots of the legislators stayed back in those days when the legislature was in session. And the other thing important about it is that's where the demonstrators were always coming by, day after day after day, coming by, such as the Angie Brooks episode that I think I mentioned here a few minutes ago. So that's why they went down there. And as soon as they got there, Senator Stone, whom I think I did mention before, who was president of the Senate, Senator Stone just told Bill Friday he thought he ought to get on back over there and run that university and get out of Raleigh. So that, I guess, shows you Stone's perspective on perhaps on that particular issue about Bill Friday. But I think, in fact, Stone was just a very very, very conservative, and really, I mean, people today would say a very reactionary fellow.
You mentioned earlier, Bob, the that this coincided with our struggle about race, which was coming to a head at this 1963 time period. But again, what was the attitude? Take us back to those times about the attitude about communist. We remember the McCarthy era. Was this part of the McCarthy era where a lot of people were really worried that the communists were taking
over
the country?
Well, I don't think it really was part of the McCarthy era. The McCarthy era had really been during the early 1950s, and President Eisenhower had actually been important in stemming or dimming, causing the dimming of McCarthy's power. And this was roughly 10 years later. But at this point in time, the racial thing was an issue, and another thing that was an issue was the Vietnam War. Because after the speaker ban was actually passed, which was in late June of 1963, the next summer was when President Johnson decided he would up the American troop levels in Vietnam by 100,000 people, which was a big, big jump. So that did become an important point.
But that was afterwards.
That was afterwards. I think one just has to understand the fact that many of the people who thought the speaker ban, DG, was a good idea were people who thought that demonstrations were a very, very bad idea and who saw limiting demonstrations the same way they saw limiting communism. I think the only way one can understand that is just to perceive or to understand the point that a lot of people thought that black people in North Carolina should be relatively pleased with their status and station that they had in life. Yeah. And if they weren't, it must be because of communism.
Yeah, that was sort of where I was trying to put myself back in those times. And there was this idea that people who were against are worried about the drive for integration and racial equality, argued that the communists were behind this idea. Mm-hmm. And then there is, we can't escape the fact that the communists were ahead of the rest of society in the sense that they saw the advantage of being out front on this issue of racial equality. And we don't like to concede them anything, but they were out there supporting this for one reason or another, supporting the racial progress, I guess, or demonstration.
Well, I think that's right. Of course, the communists were making a very great effort to sort of use or utilize or foment any kind of dissatisfaction they could with respect to all American institutions. And one of those certainly was race, where they were constantly saying that America was not treating black people in a just and fair, decent way. But there were a lot of other issues as well. I mean, they also were always trying to foment things on college campuses. Was a very popular way for communists to kind of go at things. But that was another aspect of the whole controversy, which I remember just from the days I was a student at Chapel Hill, which is that the way in which they would do that would be that they would try to stir up a number of people to be pro-communist or something of that ilk. But I never talked to a single person while I was a student at Chapel Hill, and I was there until the spring of 1965, who favored the speaker ban law. And at the same time, the number of people who were anything approaching either violently left-wing or communist at Chapel Hill was just absolutely minute.
Couldn't find them.
And, of course, one of the students who was involved in fighting against the speaker ban, and, in fact, was in very deeply involved in that battle, was a gentleman named Bob Powell. And he said that, after the speaker ban was passed, we thought maybe we should just invite somebody to come speak and see if, but we couldn't find anyone because none of us knew any communists. well, that kind of gives you an idea of what that was like at that time.
We're visiting with Bob Spearman. Bob Spearman grew up in Chapel Hill and has practiced law for a while, returning to Chapel Hill, but mainly we're going to visit with him more about the speaker ban law from the context of his role as student body president back in those times. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Bob Spearman is my guest. We're talking about the speaker ban law. Bob's given a lecture at the Wilson Library about those times, and he does it with authority because he's not only a great lawyer who can study what happened, but he also was right in the middle of it. And we've been talking about what other people did. What did you all do when this law got passed?
Well, D.G., when the law was passed, which was late June of 1963, I was actually working as a congressional intern. And at that point, we were just amazed to hear that anybody would think that one had to police the kinds of speakers that one could have at the university. And what happened immediately was that Chancellor Aycock and Bill Friday really began an effort to try to persuade the citizens and the people of North Carolina that the speaker ban law was a dumb, bad, foolish idea, which was not going to have any kind of impact other than hurting the university. And, of course, they were ultimately correct about that. What we did was initially, and by initially I mean by the fall of 1963, we began trying to put together groups of students who would go around the state and speak at civic clubs and other similar occasions to those, where we would try to explain to them why the law wasn't needed, why the law was a silly law, why the students were opposed to the law, and why, in fact, we thought it was a very good idea to have speakers of all ilks and of all persuasions come and speak on a college campus. Because as we pointed out, as we argued to many of these civic clubs, we suggested to them that the best thing you could have would be an argument between students and communists. And if you brought communists in or brought left-wingers in or brought people who had pled the Fifth Amendment in, that was bound to be what you were going to have. So that's what we did initially. And then after that,
Bob, excuse me for I want you to talk just a little bit more about that in the sense that was that two or three people doing this, or did you have?
We had a number of people doing it. We probably had of 10 or 12 people.
How'd
at
you
least
organize
10 or 12
it?
People doing it. Well, it worked out very well, except I mean, in the sense that we thought we were making a very fine case about what ought to be done. And we were working very closely at that point with Chancellor Aycock and with Bill Friday. But what happened was that they were unsuccessful. And in fact, to sort of describe the events for you rather quickly, what happened was that in the spring of 1964, which was by this time, probably 8 or 10 months later, by that time there was one could only serve in those days as North Carolina's governor for one term, which meant 4 years. So by the spring of 64, it was 4 years after the spring of 1960, and therefore there was another Democratic primary. And the Democrats running in that primary were Beverly Lake, who had run against and been defeated by Sanford in 1960, and a gentleman from the mountains named Dan Moore. So you had Moore and you had Sanford. I mean, you had Moore and you had Beverly Lake and you had also Richardson Pryor, who was certainly the most progressive or liberal candidate running. And it became pretty clear that Lake was going to take a position very much in favor of the speaker ban. In fact, he said he thought it probably ought to be strengthened, so you banned even more people from from speaking. And Dan Moore made a lot of generally vague statements about the speaker ban, though there were some of the people who had supported the speaker ban who also supported Dan Moore. And Richardson Pryor was generally perceived to be the most progressive or so-called liberal in the race. And in fact, what happened was in the first primary, Richardson Pryor ran first. But in the second primary, Lake ran last of the three in the first primary. And so the next primary was Dan Moore against Richardson Pryor. And Moore won that just overwhelmingly. He won it very, very convincingly. And at that point, it was certainly absolutely clear, I think, that no effort at sort of persuasion was very likely to have very much bearing on what happened to the speaker ban law. But the next thing that happened was interesting, which was that the Southern Association of Schools and Colleges, which is basically an accrediting institution, and the accrediting institution indicated that it was very, very concerned with the fact that suddenly in North Carolina, which was the only southern state in that point in time which was like this, that it only in North Carolina was it possible for the legislature just to pass a law saying left-wingers and communists can't appear at on a university campus. And the Southern Association indicated it was very, very concerned that the power had been taken away from the trustees and had been exercised by the legislature to just declare that communists and left-wingers could not speak at on the university campus. So with that development, you actually what happened was you had a very quick series of events in which Governor Moore began hearing that the Southern Association might revoke the accreditation of North Carolina's universities. And that was a very, very serious threat. There's no question about that. And after that had happened, and Governor Moore certainly made that clear that he had heard this from the Southern Association, then a lot of faculty began to get very concerned about
it. Bob, excuse me. Back then, the governor was on the Board of Trustees of the—I mean, he was an officer of the—
He certainly was. And in fact, that ties right into what I was about to get to, DG, which is that Governor Moore did head the trustees. There's no question about that. And Governor Moore, under some pressure from the trustees, to be frank, decided that the best thing to do about the whole accreditation issue was to have some kind of procedure where a commission would be set up to take a look at the statutes and take a look at the procedure which had been followed about the law. That was done. That was called the Britt Commission, and the Britt Commission recommended that the power be taken away from the legislature, or rather, more accurately, that the power be granted to the trustees so the trustees could decide who was to speak there. Well, that happened in the latter part of 1965. And after it had happened, then the legislature adopted the recommendations of the Britt Commission and adopted what was subsequently called the Little Speaker Ban Law. Uh-huh. And under the Little Speaker Ban Law, the power was given to the trustees to decide who could speak and who could not speak.
Well, did that solve the problem?
Well, it didn't solve the problem. Everybody had thought it was going to solve the problem, but it didn't, because the next thing that happened was that the Students for a Democratic Society, which was a left-wing group at Chapel Hill, had decided that it would invite Herbert Apthecker and a fellow named Wilkinson to come speak out to Chapel Hill campus.
Well, we're going to find out what happened next after this short break. I'm visiting with Bob Spearman. We're talking about the speaker ban law. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Bob Spearman and I are talking about the speaker ban law, and he's guided us into what seemed to be a solution, and that was that the legislature replaced the speaker ban law with a law that put the responsibility for selecting speakers on the backs of the trustees. And I said, well, that solved it, didn't it? And he said, well, sort of.
Well, they thought it had solved it, but what happened was that the Students for a Democratic Society invited two speakers, one dedicated sort of Marxist type, and another one who had pled the Fifth Amendment in connection with questions that had been put to him about speaking out on campus. And the long and short of it, DG, is that what happened was that the trustees, under a lot of pressure from Governor Moore, frankly, voted on their executive committee by an 8-3 vote that these people should not be permitted to speak on the campus. And when they made that vote, the next thing that happened was that the students decided that they were just not going to have any more of this. And the students, first of all, the first thing that happened was that Paul Dixon, who was my successor as student body president, by this time I was already off actually at Oxford going to school over there. But Paul Dixon had served in Vietnam, as a matter of fact, and he had served as a pilot in Vietnam. So it was, on the one hand, one could be critical of him, but it was very hard to be critical of him for very long since he had actually been fighting the communists in Vietnam.
He was taken up. All right.
So the long and short of it was what happened was that the students got themselves a lawyer. I got Max Smith, who was with the Greensboro Law Firm, to be their lawyer. And the students filed a suit claiming that the trustees were just implementing the same policy that the legislature had previously implemented. And the students filed a lawsuit in, I think it was March of 1966. And the suit went on for 2 years. And then the court, which was a three-judge court, decided it in favor of the students. And they decided in favor of the students, interestingly, on grounds of vagueness. And the grounds of vagueness were that many of which had actually been articulated very clearly by Chancellor Aycock a number of years before, shortly after the law had passed. But they said the court pointed to the fact that they'd said that you shouldn't have a known communist speak, but how was it to be established who was and who was not a communist? And did that apply to members of the French Communist Party, just the Russian Communist Party, or the Italian Communist Party, and so forth and so on? And the three-judge court just said that really when you look at this law, comparing it to an unbroken line of United States Supreme Court decisions, that it's very clear that this just does not have the kind of first respect for First Amendment rights that one needs to
have.
And
did that put it to rest?
And that did put it to rest. The students won it, and they won it in the spring of 1968. And about a week or two later, Governor Moore announced that the state would not appeal. And the state didn't appeal. And that was the end of it.
So the
students were really the ones who, at a point when the administration couldn't effectively do anything about it, the faculty couldn't do anything about it, and a lot of other people couldn't do anything effective about it. The students did it. And I think the students deserve a lot of credit for raising that issue and doing what they did.
Well, one of the things for those of us who are in Chapel Hill after all of that took place, the monument to the struggle against the speaker ban law, it's worked out to be a good thing, hadn't it, in the sense that it is sort of we fought for the freedom of expression, and we intend to fight for it because it's valuable to us. And that sort of is a idea that is represented by the battle against the speaker ban law.
Well, I think that's exactly what's represented by the battle against the speaker ban law. And there were a number of students who all of whom became plaintiffs against the law in this lawsuit. And And Paul Dixon actually died in an automobile wreck in the 1970s. And I think some of the people from his family had raised the issue with the university as to whether something should not be done at some point to commemorate and to praise the students who had engaged in this great battle. And the university was very receptive to that, and the plaque is down there on the wall. And I should say one other thing, DG, which is that when the night that Wilkinson was not permitted to speak, that was all put on the NBC nightly news all over the United States, which just made the university, frankly, the time being, look terrible.
Yeah, but
until the students won the day.
Well, but the images of the speaker on the other on Franklin in the Franklin Street sidewalk speaking to the students. You know, he had only gotten two or three people to hear him otherwise, but he had a whole mob to listen to him.
Oh, that's right. That's right. They certainly did.
This has just been great. Thanks for sharing your research and your experience with us as we talk about the 50th year anniversary of the Speaker Man Law. Bob Spearman.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.